afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. You can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, features, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please visit us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to questions@theorganicview.com.
Today, I'm going to be speaking to Dr. Vera Krischik. Have we created a food desert for bees? There is a great deal of concern that our honeybees do not have enough food to eat because of the amount of pesticides being used. However, most homeowners do not realize that their demand for pristine lawns and continuously flowering plants that have low to zero maintenance are a huge part of the problem. The lack of food not only affects honeybees, but other pollinators such as butterflies as well. Are we sacrificing the sources of food so that our yards can be free from the sight of plants such as clover, dandelions, so on and so forth? Even the roadside maintenance actually poses an issue as wildflowers and other beneficial plants are mowed down for aesthetics. Is there anything we can really do to keep our yards looking nice and not take away from the pollinators? Today we're going to be talking about how we can actually utilize IPM, which is otherwise known as integrated pest management, in order to help the pollinators and replenish the available food sources. So I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Vera Krischik. Good afternoon, Dr. Krischik.
Yeah, good afternoon, June.
Can you tell our audience about yourself and where you teach?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I was born in Manhattan, grew up in Carr Place, New York, and my favorite experience was going out to, down to Levittown there, to the park, and they had the barrens there. They actually had a prairie-like situation, and I actually took a field course at a Nassau Community College when I was 17, and we went out to those. They weren't called pine barrens, but they were just called the Nassau Barrens, a unique ecosystem of plants and insects that weren't found anywhere else on Long Island. So that's got my start interested in ecology. So I have a master's and PhD from the University of Maryland. I worked at the Institute of Ecosystem Studies in upstate New York for 2 years as a visiting professor from the National Science Foundation. And I've been out here in Minnesota as a professor for about 15 years. So I work on chemistry of plants and how it affects bugs. And so systemic insecticides were natural to me. It was just adding a man-made chemical to a plant. And so I've been looking at the interaction with different chemicals, different synthetic pesticides and biorational pesticides on good bugs and bees.
So when you were growing up in New York, did your parents have a garden? Were you really into nature?
Yes, yes. We had a garden, and we used to pollinate things back then with little paintbrushes. Mm. And we raised baby birds that fell out of nests. So we were kind of those European gardening people that spent most of the summer in the backyard.
It's interesting how many people, especially from this area, I'm sure, that are listening out there, have the same fond memories, whether it's with parents or grandparents. And it's just interesting how things have changed, especially with thanks to technology and education.
Yeah. So I remember as a kid we had peach trees that made, you know, lots and lots of delicious peaches.
Yeah, we would
have to stick crutches in the ground to hold up the branches. And my father would go fishing and bring back fish, and we would eat the fish, and then all the parts we'd bury under the peach tree, and making organic fertilizer for the peach tree. So, you know, you wouldn't think of spending money back then on synthetic pesticide when you could use your waste to create compost and things.
Now, it's interesting because today people are discouraged, especially since areas like Long Island are it is close quarters, so they don't want any of the bacteria that could encourage the development of E. coli to leach into the drinking water. So, my father used to do the same thing, but and there are many people that still do that, especially if they have a larger parcel of land. And It's amazing how many people still carry on these traditions that have always been very beneficial to not only the soil, but to other beings that are basically surviving out in nature. One of the questions that I'd like to discuss is about the utilization of IPM. Most people are familiar with the term, but they don't know exactly what it means. So could you start off by explaining what IPM is and why it is something that is beneficial, especially to people that are looking to, help preserve their environment?
Yeah, so IPM is a concept that emerged in the 70s after DDT was banned, and the idea was that you need to use pesticides that target only the vulnerable states, and no more broadcast spraying of pesticides. You just spot treat when the pest is out. And then through time, that was altered so that you had different options of pesticides. You had conventionals like pyrethroids or carbamates or organophosphates, but then also these novel pesticides were registered by the EPA that permitted you to kill your pest insect but not the good bugs. And so through time, you know, there's been various tactics added to that. So my definition of integrated pest management is multiple tactics to control pests that include an understanding of the life history of the pest, cultural management of the environment, like we're talking about, adding compost to the soil to promote the growth of beneficial fungi and not pathogenic fungi and bacteria, and only using insecticides when you need them, and then starting with these biorational ones that don't affect non-targets like pollinators, butterflies, and good bugs. So IPM came around from agriculture. It came around after DDT, and people realized the pesticides were needed for commercial food production, but you could have insects get resistant, and then you could no longer have that tactic. So it was a way of decreasing pesticide use, especially in highly populated areas, while maintaining pesticides so they were there and effective when you needed them. So basically, President Clinton was one of the first to say that by X in the year, I can't remember the year, 90% of all USDA-sponsored programs had to switch to IPM, not scheduled sprays. So I remember as a kid, you know, having nothing to do Saturday morning, watching Modern Farmer on the television, and you know, they'd have the apple orchard and they had the calendar, and every week you sprayed for something, and so that's the opposite to IPM. No weekly scheduled sprays. You only spray when you have a problem.
Interesting. I myself used to watch the Victory Garden.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just interesting how you look at TV today, and I'm sure I've just dated myself, but TV, well, actually the Victory Garden still is on, but you have a plethora of different garden-type channels that are out there. But, of course, the best information is always directly from people such as yourself who are experts. What is one of the most common mistakes that homeowners make when it comes to dealing with issues, whether it's a particular bug, say the grubs that appear on their lawn, or if they're trying to control the amount of clover that is growing on their lawn?
Yeah, so I would say the most common mistakes is people misdiagnose their issue. And so they don't really understand what's the mechanism that's contributing to their problem. So, you know, as a bug enthusiast, clover is great because it produces nectar and pollen for good bugs, and most beneficial insects need nectar and pollen. But if you don't like it in your lawn, it usually is an indicator that you have not aerated your lawn, especially you have low nitrogen, because clovers have nitrogen-fixing bacteria, so they can live in low nitrogen situations. So you don't need a herbicide. What you need to do is get out there and fertilize. And obviously in this heat, you can't use a very high amount of nitrogen. So milorganite is given to us by the citizens of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's a combination of sewage and then blood from you know, slaughter yards, and it has a very low nitrogen level, but it's full of iron, and you can put it on the heat and it won't burn. So misdiagnosis of your issue. Most people think they have insect problems, grubs, as you said, and it's usually a fungal disease. Now, for an insect, you know, one insecticide can kill a lot of different insects, but for fungi, they're all very, very different, and you really have to have an arsenal of different fungicides, and those often aren't available to homeowners, and lots of time your lawn guy doesn't even know what to use or can't identify it. So there's a lot of misdiagnosis out there where people are pumping insecticides into their lawn, and that's not their problem.
So if a homeowner is not sure, and say if they don't have a landscaper, or if they do and they're just not confident in the skills that their landscaper has, where can they go for proper help and advisement?
Yeah, so that's a big issue. You know, years ago there was a very extensive cooperative extension service, that there are a lot of extension educators out there that you could contact. And, you know, as budget issues increase through time, less and less people are available. But still in Nassau and Suffolk County, there is your cooperative extension office. And you can go to them, or you can go to Master Gardeners, or some of the garden centers actually have advisors there that you can ask questions of. So there are opportunities. It just takes a lot of time, and people with their busy schedules don't have the time. So I think one of the worst things you can do is go to a garden center and buy these, you know, four-step programs where it's kind of like going back to spraying your apples, the schedule of spray. It just tells you, you apply this insecticide this month, this herbicide this month, this fertilizer this month. And you probably shouldn't do that unless you really need that herbicide, or unless you really need that insecticide. You should be diagnosing the issue. So I think that's where it starts. People don't have time. It's hard to get the information, and lots of times the products that are promoted at garden center for an easy fix are not the IPM fix.
Now, we have a question that's coming from the audience. This is from Border Glider, and he wrote, are people aware that their lawn chemicals, quote, weed and feed, often contain imidacloprid for leather jackets, but which can migrate into flowers and thus kill beneficial bees?
Yeah, so that's a really important new emerging question. And leather jackets are these larvae of crane flies. These look like oversized mosquitoes as adults. And so a lot of these, weed and feed, some of them have herbicides, some of them have insecticides and fertilizers, or herbicides and fertilizers. And they do have imidacloprid. So imidacloprid is probably the most used pesticide after the pyrethroids. And it's in a class called the neonicotinols, which means new nicotine. So back in the 1600s, you would take a tobacco plant and make compost tea, put it in water, and the nicotine would, and the glycoalkaloids would come out, and then you'd spray that on your crop to deter insects. And so these are called neonicotinols because they have a similar neurotoxin that kills insects. There's about five closely related compounds. And yes, it is in your weed and feed. And the only one research paper that has looked at whether it gets into dandelions and could kill or harm a bumblebee has come to the conclusion it can't. That paper's about 20 years old now, but that's the only paper I know out there. But there are concerns that maybe higher levels, maybe if you use some kind of product that has maybe a fungicide, a fertilizer, and imidacloprid for your roses, that if you use it multiple times, that's a much higher rate that's getting into the roses. That's much higher than even from the lawn fertilizer. So what makes this imidacloprid we're talking about, this class neonicotinol, different than other insecticides we've had in the past, is you put it in the soil, which prevents it from UVB degradation. It gets picked up at the roots, and it gets into the pollen and nectar, and then all good insects, bees, butterflies, bumblebees, ladybird beetles, wasps, all of them need pollen and nectar for their life cycle. And so when they feed on it, it has the potential to harm them.
Thank you. Another question, this is actually from the same person. He wrote, I read that Vera has published a paper which discovered that imidacloprid in potted plants was allowed at levels thousands of times greater than on food crops. So gardens are far more deadlier than crops.
Yeah, that is true. For agriculture, if you calculate how much is permitted, you know, they usually say on the commercial label, the professional label, you know, X amount pounds per acre per year. And so it ends up, for imidacloprid, it's about 0.4 pounds per year. So if you back calculate that with the acreage, how many square feet in an acre, you get about 4 milligrams per square foot. And in like in a potted rose plant, you could put 300 milligrams. So I'm right now in the process of doing multiple plants, putting different amounts, milligrams in the soil, and seeing how much end up in pollen and nectar. And then we can put on that chart, you know, what the different label rates are for different landscape plants, and we can kind of get a feel for how much residue is ending up in nectar and pollen, and then relate that to what we know about sublethal and lethal effects to beneficial insects. So that is basically my research program right now, and it's on the way. You know, every year we add information to be able to make those predictions.
Thank you. And actually, we have a call. Is this Graham?
Hi, June. This is Graham calling from the UK. Yeah.
Hi, Graham. Graham White, folks. You have a question for Dr. Krishak?
Well, it was a question and observation, actually. I was very interested to read online today, when I didn't know anything about Vera's work until I heard through the network that she was going to be on with you. But Vera has apparently done this research on neonicotinoids being used in the garden center trade. And it came as a great surprise to hear that the levels of imidacloprid allowed in potted plants that you buy from garden centers are hundreds of times higher. Hang on a sec. Sorry, someone's trying to get through on my phone.
Modern technology for you. Well, that be that as it may, what is your opinion on that?
I'm on the radio.
Dr. Christian.
Sorry.
My opinion on that is it needs research to verify it, that you can see when you read the labels that you're allowed to permit higher amounts. And so we need to get the data to see how much gets translocated from the roots to pollen and nectar before we get over-alarmed. So right now it's out there as having potential. And then we need to relate that to how much would have a sublethal effect on an insect and a lethal effect. So I think it merits investigation. You know, there's very little funding for pesticide research outside of the chemical companies themselves. And so this is, although we all think that there's a lot of information behind what we practice, the reality is there isn't. And then if, you know, it's a backyard versus a food crop, there's not a lot of grant money available to figure out what's going on. So it really has been an under-researched area.
Graham,
I just wanted to give Vera some information, which was that we've had this mystery in the United Kingdom where roughly 30 to 50% of all beehives have been dying every winter. They don't make it through the winter. And the hypothesis, and I understand why she feels it is a hypothesis, is that the people among us, like myself, who keep their bees in rural areas where we have canola growing and other crops that use imidacloprid, the hypothesis that we feel very strongly is that our bees are being affected by neonicotinoids, because in 20 years of beekeeping, we've never seen anything like this. Now, the mystery is that a very well-known beekeeper in London who keeps his bees right in the middle of the city, he lost 18 out of 18 hives 3 winters ago. There's a man called John Chappell, who's the chairman of the London Beekeepers. And it's a complete mystery because there's no great fields of imidacloprid-treated crops in central London. And I began digging into this and discovered what Vera has discovered, which is that the entire nursery trade, the garden center trade, every single plant in Britain that comes out of those garden centers has been pre-treated with imidacloprid. And virtually all of the domestic lawns in the United Kingdom are treated with imidacloprid. And virtually all school playing fields, golf courses, hospital grounds, housing estate lawns, and so on, virtually everything green that we see in the city has been treated with imidacloprid. And that, you know, that was the first clue we had that something might be going on in the towns as well as the countryside. And it's very disturbing.
Yeah, so that's the beginning of a very big question. So in the last 5 or 6 years, our USDA in America has given monies to universities to try to sort out the various contributing factors to CCD, colony collapse disorder. You know, pesticides, mites, fungi in the hives, viruses, and trying to figure out the contributions. So the neonicotinoids, there's a couple compounds that are used, so it's not just imidacloprid. They're very closely related to each other when you look at the EPA-generated lethal dose 50. The numbers are very similar. And if it's going to kill a bee, it's going to kill beneficial insects. So, you know, the idea that these insecticides are contributing to bee decline is apparent to everyone. It's just trying to figure out how it's doing it and what are the mechanisms for causing it. My personal opinion is it's going to be additive with pyrethroids. They're not put on the soil. They're just sprayed on plants, but they affect the same part of the bee. They're neurotoxins. And so I think, and also in beehives themselves, you use maverick fluvalinate, which is a pyrethroid. So I think it's going to end up that there's much more exposure to insecticides than we realized when you add all the different usages together. But there's something you said, Graham, that I really want to talk about, and that's this idea of bee food. You know, what are we doing to make sure that bees have healthy diets? And sure. So I did an experiment with canola last summer. It was my first experience. I had over an acre planted, and we were actually collecting the flowers and cutting the pollen out, cutting the anthers out. And so every day for 6 months, we had very close scrutiny of the sexual cycle of pollen. And what we found was interesting. We caged bees on this hybrid canola, and we then tried to get them to collect pollen and nectar for us, and then we tried to express the nectar from their guts, and we couldn't find any. And in these little hives we put in there, we didn't get very much pollen deposited in the hives, even at the labeled rate for agriculture. And so what it ends up is that this hybrid canola is completely different than the canola of our parents' generation. So in order to create a hybrid canola seed, you need a male and female plant, and you need bees to pollinate. So yes, when you make a hybrid canola seed, it's a bee plant. And that's what they do here in the U.S. and in the Dakotas or up in Canada in cooler climates. But once you plant that hybrid seed itself, and that means in the morning it's the flower, by the afternoon the ovule is elongated and it's making seeds. And so it doesn't need bees. There's hardly any nectar in them. We couldn't find any. And there's very little pollen. So it gets back to, well, these plants that we have, this new generation of plants that are GMOs, they have seed treatments on them of the neonicotinoids, and then they're you know, resistant to herbicide damage, so you can spray herbicides. They're tolerant of herbicides. That's not all. They're actually different plants. And so that was the big thing for me, realizing here was one of the plants, beekeepers said, oh, you know, I put my hive near canola. They're going to have plenty of pollen and nectar, to realize, well, not this hybrid stuff, the parent, the old-fashioned outcrossing one. So I think we have to really realize that bees are being nutritionally starved out there. There is not gardens we can talk about offer very few resources. We have flowers, but they don't offer pollen and nectar. And ag fields now, you know, when you herbicide everything, you have a GMO that is herbicide tolerant, so you're killing all the weeds that flower and then make the bees forage on the crop where we use a lot of pesticides. We're just creating a huge problem for the bees. And so I think at some point it's kind of like if you have a horse, you have to have a field for it, you have to buy it grain. I think at some point, you know, we have to really increase the amount of acreage of fields just for bees. That's my opinion.
But they have just a point of information that might be of interest to you. We've got an identical situation over here where industrial agriculture is just so efficient now that you virtually don't see a wildflower anywhere in a field or on the margins, whereas in my childhood, I'm 60, agriculture was a lot less tidy. You know, there were a lot more wildflowers around. And we now, our natural agency, I think it's called Natural England, now are paying farmers to plant a 4-meter strip of wildflowers around the hedgerow, as it's called, in every single field. This is a condition of them getting the government grants. They have to provide some wildflower habitats, and that started about 5 years ago, and it seems to be increasing and increasing. But just a personal anecdote, I was down at the coast a few days ago photographing bumblebees just for fun, and I didn't see very many in the fields. And then I came to an area that in the Second World War was used as a bombing range, and you're allowed to walk in there, but it's still a dangerous area. And it was alive with bees because there were dozens and dozens of varieties of wildflowers, birds that trefoil, cranesbills, all kinds of mallow, and you know, it was just a completely different scene than the fields just a half mile away. So you're right, we're creating a sort of ecological desert of monoculture. So we need to get some of the wildflowers back, and in our gardens we need to choose varieties that are more natural than, say, the hybrid pansies that don't provide any nectar or pollen at all.
Well, Graham, I think that's really where people need to be educated, because they think when they, you know, put bedding plants out, pansies or even domestic geraniums or even hardy geraniums that, you know, thinking of like Orion, the blue one, or the other species that's pink, that they're putting out plants that insects can use. But all of those plants have been manipulated, so the flowers are long-lasting, so they've been denied the ability to make pollen and nectar, so they don't make seeds, so you don't have to deadhead them. So to us, that floral display is much longer. And so, you know, 95% of the plants we use provide no resources to insects. And then when you get to the native ones and some heirloom varieties, they often get taller and they often, you know, lodge, fall over in the wind and the rain, and people don't find them unsightly, they're not tidy. And so we really have created a culture way to discriminate against plants that provide any pollen nectar, but I don't think people realize that.
Well, if you plant a bed of lavender, you can watch it for months on end, and it will be feeding bees.
Right, lavender is a good plant, yeah.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Well, that's great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Graham. I think that is something that many people don't even think about. I know pansies are especially attractive because their bloom that lasts for such a long time. So is there a particular list of plants that perhaps you may have available that people can take a look at, that they can incorporate into their own gardens or even in their front yards? I know one of the popular trends here in New York, at any rate, is to plant more herbs in the front of your property as opposed to having just an herb garden in the back. It's almost like it serves a multitude of purposes. The beauty, number one. Number two, the fact that the herbs can be used for culinary purposes, and also the fact that they are beneficial to the pollinators.
Yeah, so herbs are a really good choice. Herbs, we like them because they have chemicals in them that are aromatic or tasty when you eat them. And so a lot of these haven't been derived by agriculture. They haven't been genetically selected for some other traits. So they tend to be plants that do still produce pollen and nectar. So basil is a good beneficial insect plant, or catnip, catmint, any of the dills. So most of the herbs really still are good pollinator plants compared to geraniums or pansies or petunias.
Now, with the natural plants, the wildflowers, what have you, that grow on the side of the roads, and you see it on the highways, but also in the rural portions where I don't know how often it is, but the state groundskeepers whatever their titles are, they will come along and mow down these strips of land that are right next to the road. The state obviously does it. I always thought that they did that. I was told that they would cut the hay that's alongside the roads, the highways in upstate, basically to feed the horses. I mean, is there anything that could be done differently?
Well, again, you know, I think it's they cut it for aesthetics. They cut it to maybe keep deer away from the road. They cut it so if you have a problem and pull off that, you know, there's not some dry plants there that might catch fire. So I think there's multiple reasons why they cut it. So, yeah, you know, that obviously roads go for miles, and obviously that would be a great highway for beneficial insects to go back and work with your Department of Transportation people in your state to try to foster the use of heirloom cultivars of domesticated plants as well as wild plants. And the reason why I keep saying that is there's, you know, the colonists brought over some plants from Europe, like there is a Agastache. Blue Fortune, I think, is the trade name, but there's also a heirloom garden one out there, and that's a blue. The leaves smell like licorice and has a blue flower, and that was brought over by the colonists for bees. So there are still, you know, some not native plants, but some heirloom plants that also deserve in these mixes to be used because they're better for bees. So I just wanted to add that, you know, a true ecologist who's interested in restoration will say, oh, no, we have to use only native plants, but there are also a lot of domesticated heirloom plants that aren't like, you know, domesticated in 2011 that still supply good food reserves. So I think those mixes, I think they're becoming available. So if people wanted to get this information on a plant list, the Xerces Society, Xerces, has those on their website, and they have them for the different regions of the country. And
Thank you.
Have good pollinator plants. I have a part of my website that I have butterfly plants, and we're developing a new section on bee and beneficial insect plants, which is actually a slightly different subset. So those resources are out there. The Golf Course Association has something for golf courses, how to retrofit the rough areas with plants that would conserve and bring in beneficial insects that would then again kill your pest insects and cut your reliance on pesticides. So those resources are out there, but I think your weekend gardener just doesn't know where to get them. And that's probably the fault of diminishing federal money and educational programs, but it is there. So I would start with the Xerces Society at this point.
And can you give your website?
My website is called CUES, so if you just put into Google CUES, the Center for Urban Ecology and Sustainability, and then just put University of Minnesota, UMN, you'll find it. And there's a section there called Lake Jarvis, which talks about a restoration of native plants that we put around a lakeside, and that was developed for beneficial insects. So we have that resource, but like I said, in the next few months, we do have a state grant from the Minnesota Citizen, and it's called the LCCMR, and we got a state grant 2 years ago, and part of that funds our research and part funds developing our website to give people easy access to information on what are good bee and beneficial insect plants. So bee plants are usually blue. So they're usually heirloom varieties or native plants that are blue. So like May Night Salvia is an excellent bee plant. Hmm. Any blue Veronica is an excellent bee plant. Cat mint, catnip. Bees tend to be called into blue things like turtlehead. The pinky purpley one is a bee plant. So that would be a lead for you, but that doesn't mean a blue pansy is going to be a bee plant. So we hope to have that all on our website in the next 4 months.
Why blue?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Bees are attracted to blue. Now, insects in general, you know, the Emerald Ash Borer program, they use kind of a violet-blue trap for that. So it seems to be a color for insects. So, you know, that's a whole story in itself. In the evolution of the Earth, insects crawled out of the water, and there weren't plants there. So they And most people don't want to give insect credits for this, but I think they have to rethink it. Insects were there when the first plants developed, and so they were the ones that were the ecological pressure to develop different chemicals in the foliage and different flowers, and different insects like different colored flowers. So when you see a floral display, it's only there because it's the interaction, the coevolution of the plant and the pollinator. So hummingbirds tend to like red flowers, and those that have evolved as hummingbird plants with a certain floral characteristic for a certain shape. And a lot of the wind-pollinated plants are greeny or a pale white, and a lot of the bee plants are blue. So it just has to be a true coevolution that are in interaction between the plant and the insect and what they can see the best.
That's really interesting.
So it's not exclusively blue like old-fashioned roses, not tea roses, but the old-fashioned Rosa rugosa or the seaside rose that have open flowers that only open for a day. You know, bees love the pollen. That's not blue, but it's a kind of a blue-red. So that's a whole story in itself. There's lots of research on why bees choose certain plants.
That's really fascinating, and actually I personally will look into that, because it's very intriguing as far as why bees do some of the things that they do. And I, before we move on, I just want to read some more of the comments that are coming from the chat room. Border Glider also wrote, another point is that bumblebees have evolved to pollinate specific wildflowers. If the bumblebee disappears, the wildflower disappears. So the bee and the flower species are partners that cannot exist without each other. And then he wrote, virtually all bumblebee species in the USA are in dramatic decline, 90% in some cases. And then the last comment that he made was, blue bubblia is the king of all nectar plants.
Yeah, well, so the first comment, yeah, this person is very right. There are tight coevolutions like we were just talking about turtle head is a bumblebee plant or some lupins. But there are also plants like the asters, New England asters, the different colors, and they're blue or pink blue. They're great bee plants. So there are some other plants that the flower shape isn't just for bees. The flower shape is open to, you know, other pollinators, but they're still good bumblebee plants. But when you look at those tightly coeval flowers with bumblebees, yes, that is true. You lose the host. And then the second comment, yes, buddleia. It was called purple night or something. That is the king. So if you go get yourself a white or yellow buddleia, you've missed the boat. You just have, and now they have dwarf buddleias. That doesn't work either. You have to go back to the first cultivar of buddleia we used, the purple one, and night is in the title. I'm missing it. And that person is exactly right. That is one of the best garden plants. Now, in Minnesota, that's not hardy here, but I just, you know, I buy five or six, plant them for the summer, and they're great bee and butterfly plants. But they wouldn't be on, like, a conservationist list because it's an exotic. So, different kind of commodities, we need to, you know, so buddleia would be good for a backyard, but you probably couldn't use it around strawberry fields or something.
Mm. You made an additional comment, black knight.
Black knight, there you go. That's it. I forgot it for a sec.
Well, when it comes to the homeowner, in addition to specific plants, what about shrubs and trees?
Yeah, so this is kind of a fun story. It ends up bees need to overwinter. So obviously the queen is produced in late August, September, and she goes around to these asters, these full of solidago, goldenrods, and, you know, gets lots of honey and makes fat, lipids, and then she has to overwinter. So they like compost piles, because they're easy to burrow into, and they have to be careful. They have those exposed wings, so they can't ding them up. Or they like mouse nests in the ground to hide in. And at the extreme, they like couches you've thrown away on the side of the road. They like to burrow in there with the stuffing. So one of the things you can do is set aside an area of soil texture and compost that they need to overwinter, because you could be really a good manager in your backyard and plant all the bee plants you needed, but then if they don't have an overwintering site, if they're exposed, they're going to die. So that's another aspect of it. And the Xerces Society has been working very hard with blueberry growers or different growers that need bees for pollination to set aside areas of their farms where they let it go back to, like you said, shrubby areas, wildflower areas, but places where the bees can actually burrow into the ground for the winter. So lots of times I get calls at the university from homeowners or businesses, oh, I had a compost pile and there's all these bees coming out. What insecticide do I use to kill them? And of course, you know, you stand up from your chair and say, no, they're not going to hurt you. A queen bee, bumblebee will never sting you. She is interested in eating and reproducing. She has no interest in stinging you, the queens. And so just let them emerge. And it's going to be over. One month later, you can take that pile away if it's an issue for you. So, again, it's education misconception on, you know, exactly what part of the bee's life cycle are they dangerous. You know, a wasp is much more dangerous than a bumblebee.
Well, many people, I think, still think of a wasp or a yellow jacket as being a bee, and it's, you know, completely different. Not to mention the fact that a bee will sting as a method, as a last resort method of defense, where a yellow jacket, and I've experienced this myself a few times, they'll sting you, they will call their friends and family to join in on the festivities,
yeah,
and, you know, just have a grand old time stinging.
Yeah, they have guard wasps that hang out at the entrance, and as soon as one of them again releases a chiromona chemical, then they all come out and sting you, and it's a way to defend their nest. So wasps, they're predators, so they're actually very good for your garden because they kill all the little caterpillars. They pull their heads off and bring them back and feed them to their larvae. And then the bees have evolved differently. The bees use pollen and nectar to feed on. So the bumblebees really are quite passive. You know, the worst thing that could happen is, like, you step on one accidentally if somebody's barefoot, and if they're, have a problem with the protein in the bee sting, then they can develop, you know, shock from it. But mostly bumblebees won't hurt you, and honeybees, unless you come near their hive, obviously it's the same thing. They're not interested in stinging you. We have a lot of TV shows, and just somehow all these nature shows want to show you animals being killed, but they don't really spend a lot of time talking to you about the life cycle, or I don't think they spend enough time talking to you about the nuances of animals' life cycle so you understand how to be more tolerant to them.
Well, I think
not
that's
as
because...
sensational as having a lion eat a giraffe is talking about why bumblebees don't sting you.
Yeah, well, I think it's because, you know, once again, the drama sells, and instead of providing education that is really relevant, people would rather go for the cheap thrills. And, there are certain parts of nature that have quite a bit of drama, but the reality is that is not what happens all the time. There are a lot of great things that happen, but everything plays its part. Even what you described before with the wasps do have their place in nature, but wasps are also enemies of the honeybee. Don't they also, wasps and yellow jackets, won't they also attack the honeybees?
Yeah, I don't know that much about it. You know, I bet that can happen. I don't know how often that happens. I've never observed that, but I'm sure it can happen, especially in other countries where there's different kinds of wasps. Absolutely. I just don't know how common that is in the U.S. So not to say if you get near a honeybee colony, they're going to come out and go after you. And obviously the beekeepers use smoke to calm them down, which tends to calm them down. But, lots of times you have these pretty bee plants and the bees are visiting them, and then some people who don't understand bumblebees or native bees think that they're going to go for you like a wasp would, and it's not true. So, because when you see a bumblebee or a native bee at a flower, it's nowhere near its nest, but lots of times these wasps put their nests near where people walk, and so that's a problem when they defend their nest. So it's
that's a good
again,
point.
Education is necessary so people understand that better.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, especially with the wasps. The it's they're just completely different insects altogether. It's just a matter of being able to identify the difference between the two and understand that one is just looking to do, you know, get food, reproduce, and that's it. Not looking to attack anybody, just wants to be left alone. And other pollinators, they have different objectives and they interact differently. Another comment that actually just came out of the chat room is there are 20,000 species of bees. Don't know how many species of wasps there are, but people only think about honeybees. And that is very interesting because people will assume it's a bee. I mean, how many movies have there been where there's something that's, somebody's being attacked and, oh, it's a bee. Never a wasp or a yellow jacket, which would make more sense. It's usually the bee that gets the blame. So, once again, Hollywood, I think, has taken advantage of one small component of the bee, but once again, the educational component is really what matters most, especially today, to get the right information out there, especially to the public. A question for you in regards to homeowners. When you move into a new home, or say if you want to just renovate the existing landscape, is there anything that you absolutely should not do that is very commonly done by a new homeowner or someone who's looking to renovate that really upsets the apple cart, so to speak, when it comes to the pollinators?
Okay, so I'd have to think about that for a minute.
I know one of the biggest things that I've noticed is people are very quick. Instead of having the soil tested, they just will mow down anything that's there without consideration to what the previous homeowner has done. And if they see that there's a need for evening out the or leveling out the landscape, they will dump soil. And you might just wind up getting soil that is not what the ad in the paper may have said it was, which is supposed to be topsoil. Might wind up be something that's going to take quite a bit of time to fix.
Well, I know people, you know, they get their conceptions of what their backyard should look like from a magazine ad or a TV ad. And more and more, those older gardens, which were very diverse, you know, you had a fig tree, and then you had a place for your tomatoes and cucumbers, and you had old-fashioned things like hollyhocks or Menard all, which are good pollinator plants. And they're all different sizes, tall things, short things. I think if a homeowner moves into a house that, you know, an elderly couple has left, and they come in contact with that 50s garden that, you know, might have a big blank space in it because that's where the vegetable crops went, and they didn't realize that. And then it has these plants of different height that get leggy because they're producing seed, and so they don't have beautiful flowers all the time. They just perceive that as weeds, and they want to take it all down, and then there seems to be this, you know, the year 2000, they seem to have this idea that a plant should be a little round heap that has 6 inches of space, and then there's another little round heap. And so I think what people do is they retrofit it based on the ads they see in papers, and they think that previous garden was very messy when it was probably the better garden for beneficial insects.
Well, it's interesting, as you pointed out, some of these magazines that have these pristinely manicured gardens are not what they seem.
Well, I am sure for those ads that what they do is they take, like you say, they put soil in, and then they just take the plants maybe in the pots, or maybe they take them out of the pots, and they just make a beautiful aesthetic garden, and they photograph it like that can be somebody's backyard. And now this was a stage shot, like stage pizza. And now everybody looks at it and says, oh, yeah, I want my garden to look like that. So what they do is they take out all the perennials, and then they just get bedding plants. And in the fall, you know, they clear cut it and take everything out. And I think that's where we've gone to. You just have soil, you put stuff in for the summer, and you pull it out. And because that's what the ads promote, whereas the old-fashioned garden was kind of messy. and people don't perceive aesthetically that as pretty. So, like, in your mind, if you see a garden magazine and you see a cottage garden from Europe, that's a really good beneficial bee garden with plants that have a seasonal phenology, so flowers from April to October are offering pollen and nectar. And so that April plant, when it dies, when it no longer is making flowers, it sits there yellow, but you have to leave it there because it's going through its life cycle. So you can't pull it out, and people perceive that as ugly. So I think we've really have had, because of magazine ads and TV ads that are promoting products or promoting garden centers or products used on plants, have really given us in people's minds, a conception of gardens that is definitely anti-good insect.
And it's interesting. It's almost the same with magazines and fashion magazines, where you have these models that are size -1 that are just not realistic, and it sends out this message that this is what the norm is supposed to be, and in order to conform, you have to do what they do, and that's just not reality. And the same thing, I mean, this is very interesting, because the garden magazines, there are many different homeowner-type magazines and other such magazines where they have these pristine gardens that really belong in a picture book for that very reason. I remember I worked at a building in Manhattan many years ago in which every week there was a little garden area, and every week they had new plants. They had shrubs, they had trees, they had all sorts of different things, and every week they would dig up everything. And all I thought to myself was, that's got to be really shocking for the plant to constantly keep pulling them up, and who knows what they did with them after they were done. But for the sake of beauty, what are we exactly doing? I mean, is it really necessary to do something like that? I think it's a little extraneous.
I think sometimes people think, well, if you have tall plants, you're going to have more mosquitoes. Now, I've heard that, and I don't know where people get that from. Mosquitoes do, during the day, hang by their tarsi from plants and wait till they get a whiff of CO2 or something to go find a person. So there are also some, you know, urban myths on, plant size. So usually your heirloom varieties, your natives, are taller and more leggy and, you know, not as attractive all the time. So, but yeah, definitely, you know, people get, you know, their information from the pictures at garden centers or in magazines.
And there's another comment from the chat room. This is from Porter Collider. You can create most nest boxes for solitary bees by making bundles of hollow straws, hollow canes of or blocks of wood with drilled holes. Mason bees will move in, as well as lacewings, hoverflies, etc.
So this is absolutely true. One of the things people say, if we lose the managed honeybee, you know, this honey, it's called the Italian bee, but it originated maybe in India, I think that's where they think it originated, then we're going to have these native bees, these megachilid bees, they're going to take over, but they live in the ground. So what the Xerces Society and others have worked on is they'll take a plastic conduit and they'll put bamboo in it, and then they spray it with a violet blue paint. And the same thing, like this person is suggesting, then the mason bees go in there. It's just another way to do it. So they'll put those in fields that they want mason bees to pollinate in. So that is very true. But again, they spray it with that violet blue paint. And so there are ways to, they're coming up with ways to manipulate habitat. But one of the sad things I read in a magazine was, you can buy a machine that goes through your orchard and shakes your plants so they pollinate it, so that you don't need bees. And so, you know, that is a whole new world, you know, if we do lose bees to colony collapse disorder because we don't have habitat for food, because there are too many pesticides in the foraging environment for bees, and because of the way bees are moved for almond production, they come in contact with each other so they can share more viruses and fungi. You know, if we do lose bees, we're going to have to use mechanical shakers to pollinate plants, which probably won't work with the same amount of fruit set. You probably lose yield. So it is really important for us to figure out, you know, the contributors to this colony collapse disorder, because, if you make the list of foods that we eat every day, almonds, blueberries, strawberries, apples, peaches, all of these things need bees, you know, watermelon, squash. And it's a huge list. I think it's somewhere around 75% of all our food crops need pollinators. And if bees and native insects are in such rapid decline, you know, we're going to be in trouble for, as a culture of, you know, what are we going to eat? Wind-pollinated things like wind and corn. And
now, what can a beekeeper actually do? Because there are a lot of beekeepers out there that don't have the luxury of having the land to grow these types of plants that they can forage from.
Well, I think that is a really interesting question, because traditionally beekeepers have moved their bees into crops to pollinate them. And obviously nowadays you have to work with the owner of the commodity to make sure that they're not spraying at times or spraying kinds of insecticides that bees need. And then obviously if all these crops are GMOs that are herbicide tolerant, so you spray herbicides and you get rid of all the weeds, then there's nothing left for the bees to feed on besides that crop, which might have a lot of insecticides. So it, you and I think the same thing, that you're going to have to either at the state or county level have land set aside as bee forage, or growers are going to have to, like if you own a horse, you have to have a pasture, you're going to have a bee pasture, because there's nothing left out there, you know. I remember as a kid we used to go to a farm every summer up in the Poconos, and when you drove up there, your windshield was covered with bugs. You had to get out the Windex and clean it off. And now you can drive for a whole day and you get no bugs on your windshield, because all these insects that need nectar and pollen, there's no food sources, and so those populations are crashing.
Now that New York City has lifted the ban, and I mean, there are many other metropolitan areas that permit beekeeping, but now that New York City has lifted the ban and you have so many beekeepers that exist in the city, given the fact that a lot of these plants that come from nurseries are soaked in these pesticides, I mean, it's kind of interesting, because if you think about the cities, the trees and there are linden trees. There are so many different trees that the bees can forage from. I mean, what could you do if you're in a situation like that where you're a rooftop beekeeper? I mean, should you just grow from potted plants?
Well, I know that's a really good question. Again, if you're a beekeeper and you're expecting that your bees should forage on the space that's managed by somebody else, then, you know, you're at the mercy of their management. And so I don't know about these beekeepers. The gentleman, Graham, was talking about how their beekeepers in the city had such high losses compared to the countryside. So it's an interesting question, you know, how these bees are getting by. Now, obviously trees would be good resources, but now that we have these insecticides that are being used on trees, imidacloprid is used on trees and is going to get in the pollen and nectar, and they use it on linden trees to control Japanese beetle. That's a big issue for anybody who's growing bees or interested in native bees. So, you know, it seems to me we have to take a better look at our management practices in urban areas.
Yes.
So the reason why these neonicotinoids were so widely used is because they have low mammalian toxicity. Nobody sat down and thought about the problem of them being systemic and getting into pollen and nectar.
It's very interesting when you take a look at it from that perspective, because many people don't, and I think that's exactly why we need people such as yourself to continue the educational process.
Dr. Krischik, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.